At some point, maybe in my college years, around about then, freedom became an important issue for me. Became a priority, and so I took up a kind of hippie lifestyle, which I think is maybe based on looking for outer freedom. So I lived on the road a lot. I didn't want to be bound to any one place. I didn't want to be bound to jobs and responsibilities and the customs of society. Let my hair grow out and start to turn into dreadlocks, because I didn't want to be bound by those kind of customs. And that was a beautiful life, and it offers some freedom. It kind of worked. But I think the more outer freedom I had, the more I realized that I wasn't really free internally. That it's not just a matter of being able to do whatever you want externally to be free. I realized I was still bound by my karma and habit patterns, and it's the same old stuff in the mind. So that being able to explore the outer freedom, I think, helped me to see that for complete freedom, it's a kind of an inner matter, a matter of inner work. And that's when I took up the practice of Zen. So I think from the get-go for me, Zen practice was in my mind, kind of framed around this issue of freedom or liberation versus bondage or entrapment. I know some people have different frameworks. I think I maybe talk about liberation or freedom a lot, and I remember some years ago one of the senior practitioners here said, right, that's so interesting, you're talking about freedom, that or liberation, that's never been such an issue for me. And I thought, wow, really? That's when I thought, this is maybe just each of us has our own unique framework. And for me, that's been a long-standing one. The word liberation has been important to me for a long time. In Buddha Dharma, I think for the Buddha, liberation was a central theme. Maybe that could be a sort of a loose translation of Nirvana. I know one modern scholar, monk, Theravada teacher, translates Nirvana as unbinding. So that's a lot like liberation. Not being bound. And samsara, sometimes translated loosely as bondage. So bondage and freedom, which seem to be kind of opposites. Then, you know, taking up a kind of Zen life in the monasteries for all those years, it almost seems like the opposite direction from a sort of hippie lifestyle. It's putting oneself in a bamboo tube. It's taking away all the outer freedom, or a lot of it. And I think it was maybe because I was able to really explore the outer freedom for a while that I was willing, and I saw how incomplete it was, that I was willing to give up all the outer freedom in order to really work on the inner freedom, which I think is what like monastic life is designed for. It's to kind of like constrict the outer freedom so much that if we, the only way to like survive it and be happy is to let go internally, to find a kind of internal freedom. Otherwise, it's just miserable. So maybe that's part of the design of it, actually. The 31st ancestor, the fourth ancestor in China, Zen teacher Dai. We say his name in Japanese, Dai Doshin. In Chinese, Dai Daoshin, which means great physician, a great doctor, the way of trust. So this fourth ancestor bowed to the third ancestor, Kanchi Soson, and said, I beg you, teacher, in your great compassion, your great kindness and compassion, to offer me a Dharma gate of liberation. It seemed like this was an issue for the fourth ancestor. You know, during the Shuso ceremony, at the end of the practice period, like I hope you all can come to Reverend Mushin's Shuso ceremony, where it's an old Zen case, an old Zen koan story is brought up in the ceremony, and then there's a question and answer that may or may not have to do with the koan. And usually we talk about that koan of Bodhidharma meeting Emperor Wu and hearing that all is empty and vast. And but when I was Shuso at Tassajara, Patrick was there.
And Liz.
And Well, there's magical spirits going on, divine hearing and divine eye. But usually that's just the tradition, is this Bodhidharma koan. But I asked my teacher, can I choose a different koan instead? I've heard this Bodhidharma story so many times. And he said, really? I'm like, yeah. Is that okay? And he said, okay. And this was the story I chose. And maybe I chose it because it's about liberation. I think we were also studying the teachings of the fourth ancestor in that practice period. So, Dai comes to Seng Sang and says, I beg you, teacher, in your great kindness and compassion, to offer me the Dharma gate of liberation. And the third ancestor said, well, who is binding you? And Dai said, no one's binding me. And his third ancestor said, then why are you seeking liberation? With these words, Dai Yi Daoxin was greatly awakened. Great Satori. I feel bound. Do you sometimes feel bound? Stuck. Sometimes in outer circumstances, all these obligations and commitments and restrictions, we feel trapped in the straitjacket of our outer life sometimes, and sometimes we feel bound by our own thoughts and our own habitual patterns. Why does this thought pattern keep happening? Why do I keep making the same mistakes? Why do I keep ending up in the same painful situation? And sometimes it's even a little bit more subtle. In Sesshin, we might feel less and less bound by, I hope we can feel less and less bound by our outer circumstances, especially in a longer Sesshin. Our daily life outside of Sesshin ideally kind of starts fading into the background as we enter the world of Sesshin, right? We can bring it to mind, but more and more we're living in this very simple world of zazen and kinhin, and zazen and kinhin, and breakfast and zazen and kinhin, and lunch, and so on. But then our internal bondage might come up more, our incessant thought patterns. But as the days go on in Sesshin, sometimes the mind starts to settle a little bit, and we feel less bound by our kind of gross, habitual, obsessive thoughts. I usually find the first periods of the Sesshin, my mind is like making that transition into this new world, and it's maybe more obsessively thinking than usual. But it gets tiring to do that period after period, so the mind naturally relaxes more into it. But then we might feel these more subtle types of bondage, like just like this morning we were talking about the sense of location. Right, like we're just, how is it that we are these embodied creatures with, if our true nature is like boundless, mirror-like space, how is it that we keep, everywhere we go, we're in the same location of this body, this particular localized body with its localized sense faculties? That's, sometimes to me, as I said, I'm more into Sesshin, even that feels like a kind of a bondage. I feel trapped in locatedness. I want to pervade the entire universe. That would be free. But I keep, every time I wake up in the morning, I'm like back in this body. Sleep is a kind of nice break from being in this particular location, right? We can go anywhere in our dreams or nowhere in deep sleep. But then we open our eyes and like, back here again. It's a little bit of bondage, maybe some people might feel. Bondage in a particular place in boundless space. And we might feel like bondage in a particular time. Like, we're like going by the clock, this whole Zen Sesshin thing is all built on this schedule, and why does it keep like coming up that the next thing keeps happening again and again? Can't we just really relax into like timeless expanse of brightness? Nope, the bell rings. Next thing, get up and chant something. Sit down and eat something. Next. So this I sometimes feel bound by time and space. In a way, that's a kind of a more subtle type of bondage that maybe seems not so painful compared to some. But maybe in Sesshin, it starts to become, feel problematic or constricted. So we don't know what exactly kind of bondage that Dai Yi had, but he said, please offer me some Dharma gate of liberation, some teaching to free me from my bondage. And the question, the Dharma gate that is offered, is this question. Well, who is binding you? It would probably be a stretch to translate it as who is bound. That's a slightly different question, but that's another wonderful question. Maybe even a more honed in version of the question I might like to ask. Somebody feels bound here, but who is that feels bound? Well, it's the separate located one that's in a particular time, in a particular space. That one feels bound. Well, who is that one? Who is this located, time-bound person? Or who is it that is binding you, the person? Or we could hear it as this issue of you. If you are actually the true self that's not bound by time and space, if you are the mirror, then who is binding you? Who could ever bind the mirror, right? Who could bind space? These are all different ways to look at this question. But whether it's who is binding the true self, the answer would be, well, nobody can bind the true self when we stop and look. Who is binding the small sense of limited, located body, feelings, history, past memories, self? Nobody's binding that one either, actually. If it feels bound, it's not that somebody is binding it, right? It's just the feeling of bondage is itself just an interdependent arising due to countless causes and conditions from the past have created this sense, this feeling of being bound and stuck. It's not like somebody's doing it to me. Sometimes if we're suffering in our daily life, and even in Sesshin, we try to blame it on somebody else. Why are they making me sit here? Is it that bad? Maybe it was a different practice period at Tassajara one time with Tenshin Roshi, where that came up at the beginning of practice period. Why do we have to like follow all these forms and guidelines and tight schedule? Why are the practice leaders making us do this? And Tenshin Roshi was like, you don't have to do that stuff. Nobody's making you do it. I thought you wanted to come here and do this. You knew what this was, right? Practice period, a sesshin. And people were not quite sure about that, actually. I don't believe you that we really can... don't have to do it. I know you're making us. So Tenshin Roshi had to say, well then, from here on out, this is going to be a different kind of practice period. There's no more schedule. Anyone can do whatever they want. And this was a unique practice period. And some people totally freaked out about that. Some people were like celebrated. This is going to be so great. We can here for 3 months. We can do whatever we want. And some people felt like, actually, I came here for this whole monastic experience. And did I just like, is this going to be wasted now? But the interesting thing was, even though there were no more of these restrictions, there were a few days where not so many people were in the Zendo, actually. But after just a day or two, pretty much everybody was back. They remembered, we chose to do this. This is what we want to do. And now there was a fresh feeling, and you could feel the lightness. Nobody's making us do this. We want to do this. There were a couple people in that practice period who had been living there for a long time, so maybe they were due for this kind of thing, who basically never did come to the Zendo for the rest of that practice period. they just hung out in the courtyard outside and went on hikes and stuff. And and I think, interestingly, they weren't very happy. This is my memory. They felt like it was, they were looking for the outer freedom, I think, and they had it. They would go into town and stuff even. And, but everyone else was having their own struggles of the bamboo tube of practice period, but they were happy to be doing it. So, no one's binding us. Literally, the Chinese says, no person is binding me. We say, no one's binding me, but no person is binding me. So we could also hear that as, who's binding the true self? The true self is not a person, right? The true self is the one we all share, the boundless mirror. And no person can bind that mirror. So, please offer me a Dharma gate of liberation, of freedom. Well, who's binding you? No one's binding me. Well, then why are you seeking liberation? And at that question, it all turned for Daiyi Daoxin, and he was greatly awakened. Like, why am I seeking liberation if no one's binding me? I remember in the 90s at Tassajara too, as a happily going about my life in the bamboo tube, but also feeling kind of like making so much effort to try to understand and to try to practice more deeply, because I knew I was still bound. And I heard these teachings, I read these teachings of a disciple of Ramana Maharshi. So this is like Advaita Vedanta, his teacher Poonjaji. Anyone know Poonjaji? I don't think he's alive anymore, but kind of contemporary teacher of many Westerners in India. And he's really into this, he's all about this issue of liberation too, so I think that's why I appreciate it. But he had this radical teaching of, it's only because we don't accept that we're already free that we feel that we're bound. And that somehow that really struck me. It really, that was one of those moments at Tassajara where it really turned my practice in a new direction and took that to heart. If we accept that we're free, then we are free. And if we accept that we're not free, then we're not free. And I think I've been telling myself so long, like, that's the, you know, I'm a deluded being stuck in samsara, and I'm not free, and that's why I'm here in the monastery doing this practice, and that's how it works, right? I totally bought into the view that I'm not free. Now, it's not just that because I was told that or something, I also felt not free. But what do these words mean, really? And could it be that at some point we get so used to the ideas that I'm not free, and we train ourselves to think that way so deeply that even in moments of actually where everything's fine, we actually feel quite free, that we're like, well, I'm still stuck in samsara, I gotta keep doing this. It's almost like becomes a kind of a spiritual bondage, the idea that we're not free. So I think that's part of what had happened to me. We're only actually bound by the thought that we're bound. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that could be a really deep one for a spiritual practitioner. We might even say, it almost sounds too easy in a way, doesn't it? Like, okay, I just say that I'm free now. Yeah, I can trust that I'm really free. So I think it's not just playing with the ideas. We have to maybe turn our understanding a little bit of what we mean by freedom. Could it be that I still have all these habitual thoughts and deep patterns of grasping and so on, but can I step back into a bigger picture where I see that those are just patterns of dependent arising? Everyone's got their own unique patterns of craving and aversion and grasping and so on. So we see that it's not exactly that I created those patterns. They're patterns that have been established over our lifetime, over many lifetimes, due to all these causes and conditions, which is why we're each so unique. Our patterns are all so unique. But it's not like there's someone there creating the bondage. There's no body there doing it. It's just a bunch of stuff happening. And it's painful sometimes, right? We feel totally stuck in our patterns. But if we see this bigger picture, that it's not really about, it's not me stuck in the patterns. It's just patterns. It's just painful patterns. And then if we step back even further, these painful patterns are playing out on the surface of this boundless mirror. What are these painful patterns made of? They're made of mirror. What's the nature of all these painful, habitual, karmic tendencies falling into the same trap for the thousandth time? That stuff's just made out of empty awareness. Its nature is empty awareness. Empty awareness is expressing itself as all these gnarly karmic patterns. Why would boundless awareness of this perfectly pure mirror, why would it express itself as the tight bondage of painful suffering and afflictions of greed, hate, and delusion? Why would it do that if it's totally free? It would do it because it's totally free. It's so free that it's fine expressing itself as miserable afflictions and habitual patterns. Strange. Can you follow how our Buddha nature of our true self, of all inconceivable, ungraspable, all-inclusive awareness, is so free that it's willing to express itself as like this person and that person? It's willing to express itself as these limited locations in time and space, and even more, going even further than that, it's willing to express itself as these limited locations, getting really into believing that they really are totally separate, and that's how free it is. How do we know that our Buddha nature is that free to go that far? Here, this is the proof. Our afflictions, our bondage, proves that Buddha nature is so free that it can express itself as the appearance of bondage. Right? We are the living proof. Our confused karmic beings that we are the living proof that Buddha nature is so free that it can be people like us. Yes, sir. Yeah, we can. You can go if you want. Anywhere you want. You can buy a plane ticket to Acapulco and leave tonight. I mean, at least your family might argue with that, but I say you can. And I won't, if you want to leave Sashin and not come back, I won't complain. That's what happened in this practice period, right? And people realized that they could go to Acapulco, although they'd already spent their plane ticket money on practice period. Apart from that, they could really do anything. And it took a couple of days for it to dawn on them that this whole world is so vast and wide. Why would I put on this same old robe at the sound of the bell for evening service? Because I want to. That's what I came here to do.
Well, there really is a reason. I mean, you can't fake this awakening or this acceptance.
It's true. You can't fake it, yeah.
I mean, it's easy to sit in an easy chair and say, I accept that whatever you said.
Everything.
That I'm
already free.
Yeah. But there will always come points. There will always come tests, if you will, like
yes.
a dark knife when
yes.
someone jumps out and holds a knife to your throat.
Yes.
Can you accept that?
Yeah.
Can you just give your life like that?
Yeah.
Or when you find yourself pushed out onto a stage in front of 2,000 people and have to give a speech?
Yeah, that's a great point, because that's another way to look at Sashin, actually, right? So, and maybe that's another way of talking about this story of mine. I felt like when I'm on the road and footloose and fancy free, I feel really free. But not only did I realize it wasn't free internally, but I knew that, well, it's kind of, I'm only free as long as the conditions are just right. But if I got a speeding ticket or a flat tire on the road, I intuited it actually. There too, I wouldn't feel so free. So we almost go like the opposite direction, right? And that, I think this is a valid way to look at Sashin. It's a little bit like a test. Once we feel somewhat free in various situations, then we can like put ourselves in, find ourselves in kind of difficult situations intentionally, like Sashin. It's a kind of difficult situation. So I always say, follow the schedule completely. Of course, the inside joke is, you don't have to, you can do anything you want. But we say that so that, like, for those periods where it's, I really just want a break, we say, like, actually, I'm going to see if I can feel free going back onto that cushion when I really, really don't want to. And the more we cut corners, the less effective the test is, right? So it's a beautiful aspect of Zen practice. Yes.
So, you know, my last set, I was going, you know, I was really, like, beating on myself.
Mm-hmm.
It was, like, pretty hardcore going on.
You're bound.
And I was like, you're contaminating, you know, your attitude is so bad. You're contaminating
the group consciousness.
What are you doing? You just gotta be clean. Just don't do anything. You know? I mean, it's like I'm yelling at myself. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is not working. This is going on forever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Thank you for confessing that, because I think a lot of us have that kind of feeling. You verbalize something that I'm sure a lot of people feel in one form or another, that like the self-critical inner voice, and that's called bondage. That's exactly what was happening to Dai Daoxin. He felt trapped by that self-critical thought of, not only am I just, binding myself, I'm contaminating the whole room with my energy, right? We can feel that. That's like extremely bound, right? So who is binding us at such a time, right? And again, if we remember, if we have this shift of perspective that I, my true self, is not the limited, separate, contaminating person, but it's the space we all share, the aware space we all share, like the mirror, And one nice thing about the mirror metaphor is that this mirror is never contaminated by anything, by any reflection. No matter how horrible the reflection is, it can never contaminate the mirror. It's inherently pure. And that is our true nature. No matter how dirty we feel as an individual, separate, located self, if the slightest shift of perspective, like, we don't need to eliminate it. That's a key thing. We can still keep feeling like I'm this contaminated little separate self, but the slight shift of perspective is really who I am, is not that one. Really, I am the awareness of the contaminated separate self. And that awareness is free and it's pure and it's lovingly compassionate towards every thought. Like a mirror is so receptive, right? It just doesn't mind if you take a dump right on it. Right? It just reflects that piece of crap. The mirror receives it graciously. That's like compassion, right? That's like, okay, if it's time for this stinking pile to plop down upon me, it's just a reflection. It's therefore the true mirror is uncontaminated, right? So to investigate this more and more and see this more and more. And I think it's worth mentioning too that along the way, if we forget what's happening and we feel like this mirror thing is too abstract, I don't know what Koki was talking about. I think along the way we can still, let's be kind to ourselves and know that actually people are feeling supported by us. And we're supporting others along the way. That's our bottom line. Let's keep practicing and with kindness towards ourselves, deep acceptance for our contaminated mind. Yes. Did you have
it? Sarah.
Nice point.
In a way, it's not, because I think that when you train yourself to take care of all the little details, then actually it helps your life and the lives of others too.
That's right, and also, just like we're talking about how sesshin is sort of a test of how free we are when the going gets tough. I think also that's one reason why there's so many details in Zen is. We feel more and more spacious and like, it's all the same. But then like, but actually, you ring the bell like that, right? So I think it's designed so that we don't get too into this one-sided spaciousness of it's all the same. Yes, we feel that and we still take care of the details. I think it's the beauty of Zen in particular that it's so into details. And as I've often thought, the more non-dual the tradition, the more detail-oriented it is. So if you have, like say, the Vipassana movement in American Buddhism, I think it's a little bit more dualistic in the sense that we're practicing mindfulness of breathing, we're working on these practices, there's all these lists to practice and so on. Whereas, you know, the traditional Zen is just like, be the mirror, period. There is no other practice. But when you have that kind of non-dual practice or attitude or understanding, you need a lot of detailed things to pay attention to, or you just turn into like another hippie or something. So, yes.
Just quickly, there's kind of, this is a loose kind of representation, but the idea of a hologram, if you think of it as a mirror, and if you think of shattering the mirror, it's like each little piece contains the whole.
Yes. And there are Zen stories too about shattering the mirror. Yeah. Yes.
Thinking of a situation in my own life where I believe I can handle this. Yes, I can be free. But there is also like the automatic nervous response when the situation comes up. And from what I'm talking about is when I get my blood pressure taken. And so many times,
yeah.
And I'm breathing deeply, and I'm, you know, visualizing something very pleasant. Damn! It's high! And it's like the nervous system or those habitual responses.
Yeah.
You're not free!
Yeah, it's a little bit like a biofeedback or a lie detector test works on this principle. I can be really cruel and not lie, but it like starts measuring your internal responses.
So, and, you know, a physician or whoever it is saying, oh, yes, I'm really scary, and it has nothing to do with you.
Nice. And once it's a pattern, then we feel like, even before we go to the doctor, we're like, I know it's going to happen again. I hope it doesn't happen. Of course, that's what reinforces the pattern. But so rather than that, then another approach would be, fine if my blood pressure goes up when I'm at the doctor. And I can be free with high blood pressure. I can be free being totally nervous without trying to change anything. I think this is the key thing. It's like, and then in that freedom with the freedom with the bondage, the freedom in the bondage, then the bondage starts to unravel a little bit miraculously. But if there's a little bit of aversion to the bondage, like it'd be so nice to be free without the bondage, then that kind of reinforces the bondage.
Yeah.
Fine. Like one of my teachers says that this ultimate secret practice of saying whatever. It's a very deep, profound practice. You know what happens? Okay, whatever.
No preference.
Yeah.
Well, the physician though
does
know. It's kind of hot.
Well, then next time he says that, you can say whatever. And also, I just, one more thought about when Sarah was saying, I wanted to mention, as she's saying, I try to think about how to apply this to my life. When you were saying that, I thought, do we think that Sashin is not our life? In other words, our life is like every moment. And I think if we're thinking in Sashin about how to apply Sashin to our life outside of Sashin, I would not recommend this. I would say, this is our life, and our life is sometimes Sashin and it's sometimes not. And the more we apply it to our life in Sashin, the more, and really, you know, verify our freedom in this life, then it naturally just transfers. And sometimes I think it can be a distraction for us Zen people when we say, well, all these practices sound good, but how do I apply it in my real life? And in some actual situation, as if every moment isn't an actual situation. So I think that's worth considering too. Yes.
Do in your small self. That's what you were saying, right?
Well,
you're so free that it can
I don't know if I said the word choose. Yeah, it's not that it's some. It's not that it has some. It's a being with its own separate free will or something like that. But we could say it's just so free that it's free to express itself as anything. And why is the unanswerable question. That's like the Buddha's story, right? Why did someone shoot this arrow at me, and what's the arrow made of, and all these things, and like, we're shot by an arrow, in other words, in this situation. We are a human located manifestation of a bunch of particular sense faculties. Here we are, we don't really know why, but how shall we live with this? And if we had to say why, we might just say, again, just because Buddha nature is so free, that's why. It's so free to be infinite possibilities. Okay, yes?
Does your experience of Buddha nature have other qualities than this knowing and boundlessness, for example, metta or compassion or other things like that?
Yeah. And the tradition teaching also says that although we usually, the way I've been talking about a mirror is it seems to have no qualities at all. It's like empty space, right? Empty space has no qualities. But Buddha nature traditionally does have so-called qualities of, just like you said, like loving kindness and compassion are its main qualities. But again, we don't want to personify it into some sort of entity that is a loving entity. My understanding of its boundless awareness has the quality of love, because what we mean by love is just no sense of separation. And what we mean by compassion is resonating with all experiences of all beings, not averse. It's not averse to anything. It's not averse to pain. Therefore, it can be compassionate. So, yes, for sure. Those are its main qualities, just like you intuited. And yeah, that's my experience when I investigate how that is. But I think it's important to say, this loving kindness and compassion are not some acts of like opening a door for somebody or something. They're qualities of awareness. They're the deepest sense of love and compassion. Boundless love and boundless compassion. The fourth ancestor's name was Dao Xin.
Way of trust.
Yeah, the way of trust. His family name was Sima. From birth, he was highly remarkable. From youth, he was fond of the teaching of liberation. From youth. And the traditions that taught emptiness, as if he had known them from former lives. He went to see the third ancestor at the age of 13, and then had this awakening with this story. Then he attended the third ancestor for 9 years, and later received the precepts, guarded them, and was very conscientious about them. The third ancestor repeatedly tested him on the deep subtleties, and when he knew the time was ripe, he conferred the robe and the Dharma, transmitted the robe and Dharma. In 643, Emperor Tai Tsung, so luckily now we have a Dharma-friendly emperor again. The persecution's over. And Emperor Tai took an interest in the fourth ancestor's teachings and wanted a taste for himself, so he summoned him to the capital. The ancestor humbly refused 3 times. and finally refused because he just said he was sick. Often the Zen ancestors get praised for refusing to go see the emperors, because they're like, it's prestigious, right, to go see the emperor, but it's like, you don't get mixed up in politics and so on. So they, Dogen often praises the teachers that they even when they said, come be the national teacher and you'll be the like teacher of the whole nation, they say like, no. The teacher I practiced with in Japan, Tongan Harada Roshi, was apparently once invited to be, I think, the abbot of Eheiji, which is like the most prestigious Soto Zen monastery in the world. And they apparently came in a limousine from the ministers from Eheiji. The envoy came in a limousine to, like, you know, personally invite him, and he refused. It was just kind of a small, somewhat run-down temple where he practiced. And he was, I just want to practice Zazen here with these wayfarers from around the world. On the fourth attempt at refusing the emperor's invitation, the emperor ordered his emissary, go ask him again. If he doesn't come this time, cut off his head. And the emissary went to the monastery and explained the royal edict, and Dai Darshan stretched out his neck for the sword and composed in body and mind. Okay, go ahead. And the emissary thought that this was remarkable, and he relayed the master's attitude to the emperor, and the emperor respected Dai Darshan even more and expressed his admiration with a gift of precious cloth. He loved him, right? But he was testing him. Maybe he was happy he didn't come to visit. He shouldn't be mixing with people like me. I respect him even more for not coming to visit someone like me. On the fourth day of the ninth month in 651, he suddenly said to the assembly, all things are completely liberated. This was his issue, right? You must each keep this in mind and pass it on in the future. When he finished speaking, he sat peacefully in Zazen and died. He was 71 years old. He was entombed in a stupa on that mountain. The next year, on the eighth day of the fourth month, which is Buddha's birthday, the door of the stupa opened by itself, and he looked just like he had when he was alive. After that, his disciples did not dare to shut the door again. Later, he was given the posthumous name of Dai Yi, or Great Physician. When I was on this China pilgrimage, I went to Dai Daoxin's temple, and it was one that had been badly destroyed during the Cultural Revolution, and it was one that was being especially magnificently rebuilt. It was huge, and I have some photos where there's like these welders making these metal statues of like the Dharma protectors, like Ida Sonten, one of those. It's like 12 feet tall. It's not even the Buddhas, it's just the Dharma protectors. And they're like up on scaffolding with blow torches and stuff. So you could feel there was this massive rebuild project. But the stupa, the stone monument where his body apparently is up on the mountain, up like a little like mountain trail, and but it wasn't open anymore. Maybe the Red Guard closed it when they saw him sitting there so serenely. Yeah, I didn't try it. But maybe we should try it, because he says his last words were, pass it on in the future. Keizan says, he was truly a remarkable person, one encountered once in 1,000 years. The practice of emptiness has been called the Dharma Gate of Liberation right from the beginning. If neither a sentient being nor a Buddha binds you, then how can you be concerned with life and death? Thus, it is not to be thought of as body and mind. It is not, we might even say you, are not to be thought of as body and mind. Neither is it to be discriminated as delusion or enlightenment. Though you may speak of mind or the objective world, and though you may speak of defilements or awakening, these are all just names for one's true self. There it is. He said it. So this is a prelude to our class series this fall on the true self, maybe first taught in this Parinirvana Sutra as a name of Buddha nature. It's actually, it makes it a little less, it's not like Buddha nature, it's us. That's the one virtue of calling it ourself. Therefore, mountains and rivers are not apart from this true self, nor is it different from you, the person, and your external environment. When it's cold, the cold kills you, and when it's hot, the hot kills you. This is a saying of Dungshan. We may be in the sense of the big, all-encompassing true self. You could say, when it's cold, the cold pervades you. The cold throughout the whole northern hemisphere just pervades you. It's the cold time of year. And when it's hot, the hot pervades you. Or yourself is pervaded by cold or heat. But that doesn't have to be a problem. Right? Once the barrier of this Dungshan koan is crossed, the principle of liberation no longer exists either. That is to say, there is no bondage and no liberation. Know that and know this. Therefore, none of these names is established. None of the shapes of things is distinguished. You penetrate the results of practice, so how can you be concerned with the relative and the ultimate? I think here we could say, be concerned with distinguishing the difference between the relative and ultimate truths as two different things. There are no distinctions in this place. What place are we talking about? This place! There are no distinctions in this place. Nor should you get stuck in any direction or vertical or horizontal, anything like that. If you can see in this way, you will not use the word liberation. So, how can you have a problem with bondage? You truly have a radiant light. Kōmyō. And this is called seeing the three realms, which is a quote from the Lotus Sutra. The Buddha sees everything in the three realms. In other words, Buddha sees everything. So it's saying, you truly have this light, inconceivable radiant light, and this is called seeing everything everywhere, knowing everything. Your tongue has an extra sense of taste. This is called blending the six tastes. Did you say something about the six tastes this morning? Or this afternoon? It's in the meal chant. Something about the three virtues and six tastes of this meal. We offer them all to the Buddha. So it's like salty, sour, sweet, bitter, pungent, astringent. Oh, yeah, yeah. Maybe that's what he's talking about here. You have an extra sense. But I think not. I think this extra sense, that's blending of the six, extra sense of taste, it's blending of the six tastes. In other words, this kind of taste includes all six tastes. You radiate this light everywhere, and you blend all seasonings at all times. Taste and taste, though you may, there is something flavorful where there is nothing flavorful. Look and look, though you may, there's a true color where there is no color. Therefore, there are no emperors or officials to associate with, nor a body and mind that sits or lies down. If you can reach this realm, then the fourth ancestor, great teacher Dai Daoxin, will be you. He will be you. And you will surely be the fourth ancestor. Dai Daoxin, how marvelous to see you here today. I was totally not expecting to see you here. I mean, you didn't even sign up for Sashin. You will surely be the fourth ancestor. When awakening Bodhi mind, we are one Bodhi mind. Revering Buddhas and ancestors, we are one Buddha and one ancestor. Isn't this Daoxin's saying, all things are liberated? Isn't this his saying, pass it on in the future? The door of the seamless stupa opens by itself, and the everyday features are revealed, peaceful and serene. I also have some humble words today, and I would like to express the meaning of this story. Would you like to hear them? Kazan says, mind is empty, and pure knowing has no right or wrong, true or false. In this, what is there to be bound or liberated? Even though it becomes the four great elements, earth, water, fire, water, and it becomes the five skandhas, body, feelings, and perceptions, formations, individual consciousness. In the end, seeing, hearing, colors, and sounds are nothing other than this knowing. Say it like it is, brother. Thank you, Dai Daoxin, for sitting eternally in their stupa on the hill, serene and radiant, and for coming to Sashin and supporting everyone in the universe in this way. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. And Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.